You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're only as crazy as you think we are. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, the hopeful bromantic, and I retroactively and proactively denounce everything we've ever said and ever will say. I think that that disclaimer there might apply especially to this episode because we're going to be taking on critical race theory in this episode, so it's probably extra important for us to denounce proactively and retroactively, because you know that is a hot button issue, that is a controversial issue in today's day and age, and I think how to handle it and how to approach it in our lives is important to talk about. So we'll be talking about that a lot in this episode. But first, bringing in my co-host, joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. What a beautiful weekend. What a beautiful week we've had here in California. Things are opening up. I got to play pool at the bar. I don't know that it was fully legal yet, but people are starting to act normally inside of establishments. So got to go to kickball practice and not have to wear a mask during practice. So we're getting there slowly. Things are thawing here in California.
That's awesome to hear. I've been stuck inside all week. Last week, I think I mentioned we had wrestling camp. Well, this week we had a big wrestling tournament, so I've been doing that for the last few days. Also, you know, earlier in the week there was lifting and practicing with the team. So, as beautiful as Florida is, I'm not always outside, but that's part of the beauty of it. I can have a nice, normal life here, and the people I'm around and the people I'm working with aren't dealing with a lot of the craziness. How was playing pool, William? Did you have to wear a mask while playing pool?
Well, I think we were probably supposed to, but no, we didn't. Like any good gaming of the system, we were making sure that we were sipping our drinks while playing, so no one said anything to us.
Yeah, I tried to do that trick early on at like Universal, where I would walk around with a drink, and then they're like, "Nope, you have to be stationary while drinking." I'm like, come on.
Stationary while drinking. Well, I guess you'd have to get one of those mobility scooters then.
I wonder if anyone tried that. Got the scooter and was drinking on it so he wasn't wearing his mask. But when we're talking about masks, I went to the mall this morning with Christine, and we noticed something interesting. As you know, Disney, Universal, they're finally loosening their mask mandates to the point that you don't even have to wear masks inside buildings anymore if you're vaccinated or if you say you're vaccinated. We were at the Orlando Mall, they call it the Florida Mall, but it's, you know, the Orlando Mall, the main one. And it was like people still thought the pandemic was going on there. You had to wear a mask to go in stores and everything. It was very interesting because as I've been saying on the show recently, it's like I don't exist in a world where the pandemic exists anymore. Where the way I conduct my daily life, it's like there's no pandemic and the people I'm around. But then to go, you know, 20 miles away and have people still be that way within the same city almost is very interesting to me.
Yeah, I don't think I live in a pandemic either, but then there are things that are just fundamentally different because of working remote and having to deal with the logistics of, the shop still requiring masks and things like that, makes it a little more difficult, you know? So we're not quite there yet here.
I don't know if we ever will be. When people talk about the new normal, I don't think we're going to know what the new normal is going to be for a while, because as we said from the beginning on this show, William, the consequences of everything is going to be more far-reaching and difficult to anticipate than we ever could have thought, right?
Yeah, I think the damage the damage is real, and the recovery will depend on, you know, how people act. And I think it's important for us to keep that in mind as we think about how we're going to act going forward.
And I think that's the perfect transition into what we're going to talk about this week. So hit the music. Take a good look around. This life really sucks. Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so on Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode, Locals is per month. We accept any and all contributions, support, including affirmations. That's themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. The first thing I wanted to talk about this week, William, which bookends beautifully with the way you put it, right there at the end of the intro, is another consequence, is another effect of the pandemic. And I don't want to read this article that Daniel shared in our text thread. So all of you listening, if you are, you know, longtime Midside listeners, or if you're first time, Midsider Daniel, who was a co-host for the first, you know, 9 years of the show, has taken a sabbatical for who knows how long. But we still get access to him through the Midside group text, where he still sends us content. So you can still influence the show by influencing him. But he said this article was about half of the pandemic's unemployment money may have been stolen. Now, I started reading this and it got into a lot of logistics and things like that. But this blows my mind, William. It blows my mind, especially because I think this is something that, knowing what your expertise is and what your job is, that really probably either bothers you or speaks to you. The idea that all this money was pumped into the economy, and the majority of it, first of all, even with the packages itself, the stimulus package didn't go to people. And because of the lack of information security, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is information security, most of it didn't even go to Americans, it seems like. It seems like there were a lot of basically black hat hackers taking this money and exporting it abroad. Am I wrong?
You are 100% correct, as the drop says. It doesn't surprise me, given how fast we did this and how we aren't really set up to do this to begin with. And even the way it was, the way that it was distributed via like tax refunds, which we already know there's a ton of fraud already set up around tax refunds. If you aren't aware, that's like one of the main reasons people will conduct identity theft is they'll find someone who's due a tax refund, and they kind of, and usually that's folks that have the earned income tax credit or something like that, so folks that aren't very well off, and they'll just basically file for them and redirect the funds so that they get the tax return.
Joke's on those people. All you have to do is owe the government money and no one ever wants to steal your identity.
Well, even then they'll just file a fraudulent one, but yeah, there's all this apparatus already set up on the attacker side, so it was a no-brainer.
I just don't understand it, something here, William. Shouldn't we be able to have a method of doing this that is more secure than what we currently have?
Well, you know, countries that aren't America don't have this whole concept of, like, a tax return in the sense of, like, you figure out how much you owe the government. It's the other way around. The government says, hey, here's what we think your bill is. If you don't agree, you can, you know, you can challenge it or recalculate it or whatever, right? So, I mean, it starts with that, right? And then all the information that we have to provide in order to do that. And then the whole concept of we use Social Security number as an identifier and as a security token, it's public. That's not a good idea. Yeah, there's tons of reasons why this doesn't work. But, I mean, there are computers that have been running since, like, the 1960s that do the IRS stuff. So, like, this doesn't surprise me. And I saw in that article you posted, they're going to spend something like $2 billion to try and find this money, or to improve the security process. But that, I mean, that's not it. I mean, that's not going to be enough, right? The system is just built with this fraud just sort of like intertwined in it. I mean, there's no two ways about it. That the only thing to do is, you know, what we've talked about before, which is just get rid of it and have a flat tax or something like that, right? And start from scratch with some new system that doesn't, you know, use social security numbers or is built on this whole, you know, give us all of your private information so we can all store it in some servers.
Right. And we're not even talking at this point about the morality of taxes, if taxes are moral or not. We're just talking
about the practical side. Yeah, just the practical
side. Right, exactly.
Side.
Well, the morality of the practical side, right? If you're going to implement this system, what's a way we can implement it so we're not fucking people over? Right. That's the thing. Right. We could argue all day whether taxes are moral or not. But now we're saying, is the system so impractical that that makes it immoral to implement? So let's take the premise that taxes are moral. It's moral to contribute to the social contract in a way that they're required way, compulsory way. Compulsory is the word I'm looking for. It's moral to have compulsory contribution. Right. Well, we'll accept that premise. Then it's. But our way of doing that, of executing that, hurts you to the point that is it moral to continue? Do you get what I'm saying? So now we're twofold down with the taxation system.
Well, not and then it's even one layer deeper, Justin, because most of this fraud was from unemployment insurance, which is, first of all, administered at the state level, meaning like there's 50 different ways of doing it. And it's almost all those states, it's government. You know, the unemployment insurance is government, right? So they are, and in even another layer down, it's administrative law, meaning you're guilty until proven innocent, and the guilty party is always the business. So therefore, like, I have to fight fraud all the time. People will, you know, will terminate people, and they'll claim, or someone will leave my company, and then they will claim we fired them so that they can get unemployment insurance. And so I have to provide, the burden of proof is on me to provide evidence that they left voluntarily. Now, voluntarily leaving can be not showing up for work for a certain period of time, right? So, you know, I have to document, well, these were their shifts and they didn't show up, so it was job abandonment, right? They don't, and so, but guess what? They still get their money, their unemployment insurance. It's just, I don't get dinged for it. So, like my insurance rate doesn't go up. So the rabbit hole goes even deeper, right? And most of this fraud was stolen from that, right? So you just, you know, make up some things and basically hope to pick a company that's either overwhelmed or unable to respond. I mean, imagine that. You're trying to hold your company together during the height of the pandemic, and you're getting inundated with unemployment requests, right? Now, thankfully, I'm small enough that I can handle that. But imagine, you know, just being slightly bigger, like a mid-sized business, and having to handle all these fraudulent requests. And not knowing which ones are fraudulent and which ones aren't, right? And then having the COVID exception just saying, well, just shut up and give them money because it's COVID.
Right. Well, and that's where, again, these things are all interrelated, right? We've focused a lot on, you know, masks and social distancing and that side of it. But that's how these things are all interrelated. And to me, the guiding principle here, and I'm not saying it's a good principle, but I'm saying the guiding principle that was used here seems to be, do more harm than good. And I'm going to invert that to the real principle that matters here is, I think we have an example over the last year and a half of how all the measures that were taken to support society as a whole overall actually did more harm than good to individual lives. I don't think I can point to one thing that was done and said that benefited on average individual lives. Now, obviously, we can point to, for instance, with masks, one person that they helped, right? I'm not talking about the exception. I'm saying in general, William, all of these things and all of these solutions actually cause more problems than solutions.
Yeah, it's inevitable if you're going to do something at this scale that there's going to be issues. So I don't want to sound overly pessimistic, but at the same time, we know government is not the way to do a lot of these things. And then we're surprised when it doesn't work the way we thought. And like, there's a lot of money now that's gone to some very bad places.
Well, and that's even a secondary. That's a secondary thing, right? Primarily, it didn't go to the people we were trying to help. And that's the irony here, right? This is one of those things, William, that I say, once you figure out in life, life is actually backwards from the way we're taught it is, or you would think it is. So you would think that taking action and doing things, especially on a mass scale, would be good, right? You would think that, oh, having a government, having a body, a group of people that's there to help everyone would be a good thing. But when you look at reality and you accept reality, it's as you said, you see that it actually can't work, that there are always negative trade-offs. So it's always better to do from that side of things as little as possible. And that's one of those things that sort of blows your mind when you realize it. Because it seems like, even when I just said it, it sounds like I'm fucking insane, right? It sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's true.
Yeah, I think we want to make sure government is limited to only the things necessary for a civilized society. And that's protecting individual rights. When we stray outside of that, it's just a ball of unintended consequences.
Well, and I think that leads perfectly, William, into the second thing that's really important to talk about this week, because it's a very, very difficult topic. And it's one of those things that came across my phone, you know, it came across my desk, quote unquote, because it deals with Florida. And on average, over the past year and a half, Florida has been knocking it out of the park, right? DeSantis, with the way he handled the pandemic, with the way he handled the responses to the riots, everything he's done has knocked it out of the park, right? And I want to say everything because people are going to be like, what about his social media thing, right? Not everything. But on average, he's knocked it out of the park because he's identified problems that are threats to individual rights, and he's come up with solutions that don't also hurt individual rights. But we've come up against one of those. We've come up once against one of those that doesn't have an easy answer. And I say that because I don't have an answer to this one, William. I don't. I really don't, because I get it. I get it. So Florida has announced that they're banning the teaching of critical race theory. Critical race theory is, of course, the idea that, and I'm going to use their own words in the name, that race is the critical way of understanding the world. It's looking at how race and human interactions about race have shaped society. And specifically in America, it's talking about how whiteness has controlled society and controlled American culture, and understanding that, and understanding how that has affected other cultures. So it's looking at things primarily from that lens. Now, William, I think you can agree with me that that is a theory we disagree with.
Yeah, 100% agree.
Okay, so that's where I want to start with.
So to the extent that race is the only factor, right? Like, that's right. What critical race theory says.
Right,
the driving primary. Yeah.
Right. And race is certainly a factor, and that's part of what I want to talk about here, right? So we are not in agreement with critical race theory. Now, to me, there is a difference, William, between being in agreement with something and teaching it. Now, when I say teaching something, I don't mean you're teaching it for people to agree with. You're teaching that this theory is a theory that exists and that there are people who agree with it and forward it. It's the same thing as teaching communism. I don't agree with communism, but I think it's very important that communism be taught. Now, here's where things get difficult. The critical race theory people key in on the word you said. Only, William. It's the only thing that matters. So they don't want critical race theory to be taught in the sense of taught alongside everything else as a possible theory through which you can look at the world and you can use that as your theory to approach everything. They want it to be taught as the guiding theory of all education. So they want all pedagogy. They want all curriculum design.
Everything from math, arithmetic, to sports, even. They want everything to be in that rubric.
Right. And when we say sports, it's how you teach. It's how you select a team. And it's the same thing with that's why I said the word pedagogy, William. Your methods of teaching, right? The idea that a lecture would be a white supremacist technique, because it's saying I'm the expert and you're the non-expert and I am going to talk to you and you have to listen to what I say. They would say that that is a white supremacist technique, and therefore it is bad. It is oppressive.
Yep. Right. Not so, having, biological women have their own team. That would be white supremacy, right? That's literally a thing. I'm sure I can find people who have said that, right? If you don't think that there should be trans women on female sports team or any sort of criteria, right? Like we've discussed in previous episodes, like all the different ways you could draw those lines. Even talking about drawing those lines and coming up with the distinction and recognizing the sex differences, biological sex differences, those are all white supremacy in CRT.
Right. Right. And again, to me, these are conversations to have, especially as kids are growing and learning. They should be having these conversations. What are the lines? What are the purpose of categories? What are the purpose of different teams? Why do we section different people into different groups? What does it achieve? How does it help them? How does it hurt them? I think those are important discussions to have when you're learning about the world and when you're trying to figure out who you want to be and what kind of world you want to live in. They're also important discussions to have pragmatically, when you're trying to establish an organization or a new system or a new way of doing things, which is why you need to have those discussions when you're younger. But when you start saying one theory is the only theory that should be taught, right? If I started saying, William, individualism is the only theory that should be taught, or we'll go more extreme, objectivism is the only theory that should be taught. If I started saying that, I would hope people would tell me I'm an asshole.
Yeah.
And there's something wrong with me because that's not good education. So here's the problem I have, William. I get why Florida did what it did, right? I get why it banned it, because critical race theory is saying not just we want to be taught, but we want control of everything and we want to be the only voice. That's a problem. And you need to get ahead of that. But I think it's really bad for education and freedom of thought and individualism to ban teaching anything. But it's like either of those two ways you go is a problem. So you're stuck in between two shitty options.
Yeah.
So maybe...
Well,
maybe...
I think there's another distinction here, though, too, Justin.
Go ahead.
There's a difference between teaching and indoctrination. And
yes.
And this is super important, and we've handled it not particularly well, but attempted to when it comes to things like religion and even political ideology in public schools, right? And it's messy. And the whole problem is you know, based in public schools. But even if you were teaching at a private school, right, and you had specific values or even specific political ideals, right, you would still struggle with this from an indoctrination standpoint, meaning you want folks to engage seriously with ideas. But and you may even want to persuade them in some cases about certain aspects of philosophy and ideas. But there's a huge difference there between that and indoctrination, right? It becomes much more like a religious order. And that's what we see with CRT. And so when I read a lot of these headlines about banning the teaching of CRT, I think in some ways it's a kind of a mixed bag, right? Meaning like it's really we need to ban indoctrination and quote unquote, right? That's the thing that we need to avoid. The issue is inbuilt in CRT is this idea that nothing can be understood outside of its lens and that any challenge to it is immediately racist.
Right. And
it's a poison pill.
Right. Well, and that's exactly the thing is what I'm saying is they're like, oh, it's a poison pill. Well, we just won't allow the poison pill to be ingested. And I get that. Right. I get that. But it's exactly what you just said. I think the more fundamental problem is our language of education, our language of learning, where wouldn't a third option have been no poison pills are allowed or framing things in a way that are as a poison pill are allowed, or, you know, take the example you use of the separation of church and state. Shouldn't there have been a sort of separation of indoctrination and education clause or something. Maybe we need that in the Constitution. And I even like that language, indoctrination versus education.
I worry about that because I think it's one of those. I think it's hard because we want to instill values, right? So the problem here is the public education. So let's take it out of public education for a second and just imagine you're have a private school. You should. There's no way to teach value-free education. There's no way to avoid a form of indoctrination. I mean, go ahead.
Just for one second to make a point. This goes back to what I said earlier. That's one of those things that once you figure out about life, it sounds like it's not true, but it is. The idea that you can't get around teaching values and teaching people how to live every day. Your method of teaching is teaching values. So
That's exactly the point I was going to make, Justin, is that in any rational, idealized private school, they are going to be biased. In fact, they will indoctrinate students towards reason. There's no way to avoid it, right? It's built into education. And so it's not indoctrination necessarily per se, right? Unless we're talking about indoctrination unless we're defining indoctrination to mean turning off your mind, right? There is an aspect of indoctrination that involves that, right? When you talk about religious indoctrination and even CRT, which I consider a religion, it's about avoiding looking at reality, right? It's about, focusing on these floating concepts and floating abstractions and drawing like civilization-wide conclusions based on it.
I'm going to back up what you're saying. I just Googled really quickly the definition of indoctrination, and this is just the one that comes up when you Google it. I just Googled the word indoctrination. It says the process of teaching a person or group to accept a set of beliefs uncritically. And the key word here is uncritically. That's where you have indoctrination versus education.
Yep.
What you're arguing is it's impossible to teach someone without teaching them to accept a set of beliefs or principles. It's impossible to. So you're either doing it intentionally or unintentionally. If you're doing it unintentionally, I think I would argue you're just not a good teacher. Because it's random, it's happenstance, right? It's the idea that I'm going to teach you how to play football, but it's just going to happen by accident. Well, the purpose of doing any job is to do it intentionally, right? You don't fix a car and go, well, how did that happen? I don't know. I just did a bunch of stuff and the car got fixed, right? So there has to be intentionality in your profession. So I would throw out the lack of intentionality. But then you have the intentionality, right? And are you intentionally helping them think about what they're believing? Or are you intentionally just trying to get them to believe something without thinking about it? And right.
Disavow some of what I said earlier. And we can have that clear definition of indoctrination. And if we're talking about accepting things uncritically, I would sort of argue that's the opposite of education. Because in order to really understand something, you have to be critical of it, right? You have to integrate it into your other knowledge. And part of integrating into other knowledge is understanding its sort of scope and context, which means you have to be critical of it. Where does it fail? Where does it break down?
Right. And this is where we wrap back to the original problem. And when I say wrap, I mean we fold back to the original problem. Teaching critical race theory, as the supporters of it want to teach it, is indoctrination. It is the uncritical acceptance of this idea, of this worldview. But on the other hand, banning the teaching of critical race theory is indoctrination, because it's saying we don't want you to critically look at the alternatives of what we think the good values are. So both approaches, while one is one we agree with, and what I mean by agree with is we agree that critical race theory is a poison pill, it's a threat. But while we agree with the side that says the poison pill is a threat, they've also, William, created their own poison pill that's more long-term. Remember, something we've been focusing on the show recently is short-term versus long-term. Yeah. Right now, critical race theory is the short-term problem. But the long-term problem of saying you can't teach these ideas is a poison pill for the long-term. It may not kill you in 5 years. It may kill you in 50. And that's the problem, because they're not having this discussion of we should be passing laws about how to teach, not what to teach. We should be saying indoctrinate, don't educate. We should be saying the focus should be on critical thinking. Yeah. The focus should be on.
Well, I would go a step farther. The solution to this is not easy because it's a long-term solution.
Right.
You abolish public 100%. Schools and you abolish public funding to colleges. And this problem will evaporate because reality will take this will tie education back into reality. And this problem will, I'm not saying it'll evaporate like just magically. I'm saying that you will have scholars that will attack this ideology and tear it down because it doesn't correspond to reality. But that will take time. So if we can agree on that, then it just becomes, okay, well, what's the right thing to do in the short term? And I don't know if banning it is the right thing to do. And I kind of like your idea of saying like, hey, we need to have this focus on education versus indoctrination, and that, hey, in our school system, indoctrination has no business in this. I mean, you see this in a lot of old school, more Socratic private schools, or even some of the military academies. There's this huge tradition of being able to criticize even an idea you hold, right? And to take alternative views seriously, right? And debate from that alternative perspective, and debate effectively from those alternative perspective. And that's a great mind training exercise. But we've seen, I can't remember the name of the school, but there was a British school where someone covered something related with trans issues or critical race theory or something, somewhere in that space, right? And just having that debate caused people to get fired. And it was like, wait, we treat this subject just like every other subject where, we have people take different sides and then debate from it. And people got in trouble for it. So this is because of CRT, right? Because of these ideas. Obviously if you even debating this or criticizing this is racist, and it made people unsafe, feel unsafe, right?
Right. And that's my problem with CRT as a person and as an educator is I believe what you said. What you said is to truly believe something, to truly be able to argue for something, you must be able to argue the opposite of it as if you believe it. You must be able to present the best case argument for all sides to be able to know what the best case scenario of all sides is. And with CRT, you don't have that. And that's why I get the idea of let's ban it. I get that. I get that impulse. I get that impulse. But you can't, because let me ask you this, William. Let me ask you this hypothetical. What if a teacher brings it up and simply says critical race theory exists, this is what it is? Is that teacher then in violation of the law for teaching critical race theory?
I don't think so. I think what they're talking about here in this Florida law, but I haven't read the actual law yet, but in other states I've seen similar things. What they're doing is they're trying to prevent it from going into the curriculum, because the curriculum guidelines were starting to include CRT elements in things like mathematics, right? 2 + 2 does not always equal 4 sort of thing, right? And so that, I think that's, logic is white, right? Those are the things that they're trying to ban. I'm not sure that you can do that with a law, but unfortunately, because it's a public school and that's the, everything becomes political then, right? So the curriculum becomes political. This is just similar to, the evolution debate, right? It's the same sort of debate here. We have this movement to try and get creationism into the school and then alternatively ban creationism from the curriculum. I think you're going to see the same sort of debate replay itself from the 80s about CRT, about, well, should we include it in the curriculum and teach it as an alternative or ban it, right? Like,
with the
can
sides
you imagine?
Flipped.
Yeah, but the sides have flipped. Yeah, but can you imagine? Like, as history goes on, I mean, there's no doubt now with the anyone who studies history understands that communism is evil and has completely, it's just morally bankrupt, right? And you can, I think you can objectively teach communism, still steel man it, give it the context, and then also teach that it is morally corrupt and evil and bankrupt, right? That can still be objective and objective, but without indoctrinating, you can objectively teach that because we have enough history now to see it.
Because you need to be able to understand what its best case is in order to understand why it's bad. You can't understand why it's bad if you're always dunking on it like, you know, the right-wing check marks on Twitter are. Like when Ben Shapiro dunks on communism, it doesn't actually prove communism is bad. It just proves he doesn't fundamentally argue with what communism actually is. And that was my thing, dude. This is why I said it's the sides have flipped. Like, I was one of those people who was like, yeah, teach creationism in schools. Do I agree with creationism? No. But do I want it taught in the schools? Yeah, I want it taught in the schools. I want kids exposed to that idea.
Yeah.
I want kids to know there's creationism.
And exposed to how it is criticized, right?
Right. And how people make it their whole life system. It's the same thing with critical race theory. I want it taught in schools. I want people to say it exists and how it's disagreed with. But it's the same thing that you said. I think you made a very important point. We're not talking about when they pass these laws, it's not, oh, here's what we're doing in the humanities classrooms. They're worried about how this is with everything. 2 + 2 = 4. Well, with critical race theory, we're worried about them saying, well, logic is the white man's tool, so 2 + 2 doesn't always equal 4. It can equal whatever you want. Or with creationism, we're worried they're saying, well, 2 + 2 = 4 because God said so, not because these are symbols we've assigned to quantity groups, and we know if we combine these quantity groups, we get a different quantity group. Why does 2 + 2 = 4? God said so, and that's the way it was when he created it. So there are concerns with either when we don't always think about it's bleeding into science and math and less humanitarian aspects, right? I mean, I think people wouldn't really have a problem with creationism being taught in a religion class. I don't think people would have a problem with critical race theory being taught in a sociology class. But we don't realize that they ban these things because, as you said, they're worried about it bleeding into everything else.
Yeah, I think that's the main concern. I agree.
Right, but the difficulty is, again, the language, William. We talk in this all-or-nothing language. Ban it. That's such an all-or-nothing language.
Yeah.
But again, it goes into the last thing I want to talk to you about. We kind of have to because, and I'm not saying I support all or nothing language, but I get what people are afraid of because it's something that I've dealt with personally, and I'm sure you've seen me deal with personally on social media, where people will be taught these things and then they'll try to fit the world into them. And what I'm talking about is something we always talk about as we analyze Zack Snyder's movies and the ideas in them. And we see this individualistic element to them, right? We see this influence of Ayn Rand on him, of objectivism. And we've never called him an objectivist. I would never call him an objectivist. But we see that. And it's very clear to us. And then other people will come at me in specific and tell me how crazy I am. I've had people literally tell me I'm crazy, that I've invented things in my head that I don't know what I'm talking about, because they try to fit him into the social justice worldview. They try to see him, well, he's a good person, so he's a social justice warrior, right? So he's an individualist, and he wants everyone's voice to be heard, and he wants everyone to have what they want, and he doesn't care about things like race and gender and orientation. So they assume that, what must he be, William? What do they assume he is?
I would say they assume he's just your standard left-wing, you know, Hollywood member, right? They assume he's a frat boy, right-wing troll, right?
Right, and the right-wing troll is not the people I'm talking about. But even them, they're trying to look at things from their leftist worldview.
Exactly.
And they're fitting
him into
that. He's
not left enough. Yeah.
Right, and it's either or. But all of them are trying to fit him into that social justice worldview, because the only way you can support those things are it through their worldview. You could only support a black person being a hero if you believed in social justice. That's what they think. So they try to fit him into that. So I had a very interesting experience recently where Zack Snyder did this podcast. It's called the Nonprofit Podcast. The podcast is by these two men. Their names are Mark Twight and I believe it's Mark Blevins as well. I know the last name is Blevins. I just realized they have the same first name. But these are people who helped train people in 300, Henry Cavill, Gal Gadot, Jason Momoa, look the way they look for Zack Snyder's movies. So this is a strong relationship Zack Snyder has with these people. This podcast, the Nonprofit Podcast, it was a three and a half hours of Zack Snyder talking to Mark Twight about all sorts of topics. And this is, first of all, William, before we even delve into these couple drops, it blows my mind, William, that there are people in this world who will call themselves fans of someone and then that director does a podcast like this and they would never even listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like this is
in a library on some microfiche, right? This is available in your podcast app right now.
Right. Exactly. It's easy to get to, but he's not talking exclusively about DC, right? When the things people listen to, it's like he goes into the, canon's not the word, the mythos. He goes into the mythos of the universe. They want to know about the comics portrayed on the screen, or is there a time loop in Army of the Dead? That's what they listen to. They don't listen to when he talks about his ideas and his beliefs. And that blows my mind, because what matters more to a story? The time loop, or why the time loop exists?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, if you don't really understand the story until you dig that deep.
Right, so I listened to it for you, and I dug out like the three most important minutes. If you follow me on Twitter, you see that I put them out there on Twitter. Now, interestingly, when you put a video out, you can see only about 150 people have viewed the first video, so that even tells you how many people even care when somebody puts it in front of them and says, this is important. But I took it out there. I took it out. I pulled it out. I sent him to William. We're going to play the first 2 minutes. Then we're going to talk about them. Then after those 2 minutes, we're going to talk about the last minute. And we're sort of going to say like, hey, this is how this is important and how it shows it's evidence of what we've been talking about all this time. Because I think this is super important. It was very gratifying for me, William, to hear this, because I was like, yeah, I have been right all this time. So let's play the first 2 minutes here.
You like what you like. You know what I mean? And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's kind of the journey, you know, to find, because I think when you find what turns you on or what makes you do your best work, you know, you it's okay to be rude. And I don't mean this in a bad way. It's just about wanting it, you know, about pursuing it. It's okay to make that, to be obsessive and to be crazy about it, because it's kind of the why of existence in a lot of ways, you know, because in those moments when you're making a picture or in that or seeing that performance or feeling that feeling, you know, I mean, it's obvious. I'm not saying anything that nobody doesn't know, but I think sometimes people are bashful about wanting it. You know what I mean? They're bashful about the pursuit of it. You know, they feel self-conscious that, like, am I being rude? Because am I being selfish? You know? And I think that's the thing that it's okay to let go of, because it's not, you got, that's the why of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and it, you know, am I being selfish? Yes. And is that okay? Also, yes, I believe.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, in the sense just that, you know, how did selfishness at the expense of others? That's how the term got, I think, a negative, you know, sort of connotation to it. Right. But if it's like, look, I'm solely pursuing what it is that I want to do. It's not costing anybody else anything. In fact, I'm dragging a lot of my friends along for the ride.
Sure, sure.
And they're also maybe kind of seeing the similar thing.
Sure.
And we'll just all go into this together. But it was originally me just doing what I want to do. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
It really is.
William, this blows me away. First of all, that he just talks about, to start with, you wanting what you want and just wanting it, and that's okay. And then he says, William, It's obvious. I'm not saying anything anyone doesn't know. I think this is a little bit of Zack Snyder being naive. I think it's a little naivete. That's something we always kind of touched on, and I've had private conversations about it. I don't think people know it. I don't. I think it's not something that's taught in our society. And then the thing that blows me away the most about this entire thing is he's the one who brings up the word selfish. And then Twight talks about what we always say. There's a difference between selfishness and selfishness at other people's expense. And that is something, William, that you can figure out on your own. But that is something that Ayn Rand said very clearly is a package deal. And very few people who say that have not read Ayn Rand. If you say that, odds are you've read Ayn Rand. And I know for a fact, I can provide proof, and I'm not going to, but I can provide proof that Mark Twight has read Ayn Rand. In fact, you could say it earlier or later in the episode where they talk about the Fountainhead. They literally talk about the Fountainhead and what it's about. And it's clear, even through this quote, that this excerpt, that Snyder understands what the Fountainhead's about, and it's not just a cool book about architecture and sex, right?
Yeah.
And Twight brings that up. And when we talk about that, William, that's narcissism, the idea of selfishness plus at other people's expense. If you're truly selfish, you're not doing things with the intent to hurt other people. And Snyder brings up the word selfish, and he agrees with everything that Twight says. It blows my mind.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you get some of that, you know, Dagny vibe of, you know, do they want to live, right? Like there's, in the premise here is, well, obvious, it's obvious, right? It's obvious. It's obvious to people who have such a good grasp of reality, right?
Right. Who've done the work, so to speak.
Who's done the work, yeah. But that doesn't mean it's obvious for everyone, right? And there's a huge societal apparatus, you know, around muddying the water around that particular issue, right? Living for yourself.
Yeah. I think that comparing Snyder to Dagny is such a good comparison. I think it's very clear at this point in time that the character he is most similar to in Rand's writing is Dagny. He is very clearly a Dagny. I think that's a great
William, my degree
it.
From FU says you are 100% correct.
I love how terrible I sound in drops. Like, Snyder and Twight sound so smart, and I sound like, "Raw, you're Gilbert Gottfried." Like, but yeah, it's just, I mean, if there was ever a moment, William, for him to disavow the word selfish and go against those ideas, wasn't it that moment right there?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
All right. And he builds on this more. So let's play the last minute here where he builds on that.
Beautiful, beautiful thing.
And, it really is. And I think that's, you know, that's the thing. I think when we run hard, because in your youth, you know, you tend to run hard for the sake of it, you know? And to have said I ran hard is not, but it's literally, you know, and maybe that's fine because you get a high from it and that might be okay, you know, but I think that, you know, for me, I guess it's just this sort of pursuit of this aesthetic is, you know, that I used to wonder about the why of it, you know, and now I think I'm just at this place now where I feel like, you know, when I'm making an image or telling a story or whatever it is and that I like the way it feels, that's enough, you know, that's enough for me. It is.
Oh yeah.
Like, that's enough. People are like, well, what is it? Like, what's the why of it?
William, it blows my mind that it sounds like he's become more rational and more objectivist. And that's the thing, like, to have gone through something that he's gone through, and we all went through, right? I mean, I got a tattoo of, you know, the Justice League logo with my initials to commemorate what we went through. And to come out of it the other side and be more rational, I don't want to say more objectivist, I want to say more rational, more healthy, shows how strong of a person he is, how good of a person he is, right? Because he actually said, I used to wonder about it, but now I'm to the other side and that doesn't matter. It's just, this feels good to me. And that's something too. Like, I don't think he's talking hedonistically. This is a person who understands principles of reality, of how to create what he creates and do what he does, whether it's bodybuilding or creating movies. He's proven that he can work within reality. So he's talking about feeling as the outcome of the combination of precepts and concepts. He's not talking about hedonism as the feeling as the primary. And that's what blows my mind is Siri saying this aesthetic, but he's seeing aesthetic. When he says aesthetic, William, what I hear is aesthetic is the rational pursuit of your life, your values. I'll say it even that way. Your values, the rational pursuit of your values. Am I hearing the word aesthetic wrong when he's saying that?
No, I think so. I for some reason it pops into my head. Patrick Rothfuss has in some of his books, he has this idea of playing a beautiful game. In other words, it's not good enough just to win at all costs, right? You want to play a beautiful game. And there's a couple characters that embody that in some of his books. And I'm getting some of that vibe as well, right? Like it's like, I want to have that. I think that's part of that aesthetic, right? It's not just, you know, I got my way or I forced it in, but it's like, and it was beautiful, right? Like the way it came about was also beautiful.
Well, that's actually something they talk about later on in the episode, where they talk about
love for
the process.
Man, I didn't even listen to this, and I'm predicting the future.
Well, it's because they're rational and logical, you can figure it out, right? It makes sense. They talk about the love for the process, and they say if you don't love the process of something you're doing, and you're only doing it for the outcome, the end point, you're never going to actually do it as well as you could possibly do it, and you're going to end up hating doing it. And I think that's what you're talking about. And when he's talking about the aesthetic and when you're talking about the way he's talking about it, that's what you're referring to. The idea of if you don't love the process, you only love the endpoint, then you're going to hate it. And I think to make a comparison to another, you know, golden goose here in the midside, I think that's something Tom Brady figured out early on, where Tom Brady won the Super Bowl his first year starting, his second year in the NFL, and he got to the end and he said, this is it. This is the top of the mountain. And he realized it no longer was about just winning the Super Bowl. It was about the process. And he loves the process. And that's why he doesn't want to retire. And he's developed the TB12 method. Because he loves the process of every day doing what it is he loves. And the game is part of it. And the victory is part of it. And the Super Bowl is part of it. But it's not the end-all, be-all. The outcome is not the end all be all. And I think you have to approach that way because that's life. Imagine if you lived life for the end of life, for the one feeling on your deathbed. How many days would you waste? How many years would you waste? And then you're on your deathbed and you're like, oh, wow, I feel good. Wait, do I? And then you would have like an existential crisis as you're dying, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got to integrate your values. And part of that is loving your life and the person you're making. It's a becoming, not just an endpoint. That doesn't mean you don't celebrate the endpoints when they come. Right? You can be on your deathbed and say, wow, what a fulfilled life I've had too.
Well, and that's the feeling I hope I have on my deathbed, because I hope I feel like, hey, I did the best I could. But it's the same thing like with what let's wrap it back to Snyder. It's with watching a movie, right? Yeah. You celebrate those movies. But you also get ready for the next one and enjoy making the next one, because you're never going to enjoy that outcome if you don't enjoy the process. I mean, to me, it's like it's being a fan of a team as well. Are you going to enjoy that Super Bowl victory as well if you don't enjoy every regular season game? Like, I don't understand, William. I don't understand fans who just watch the first game of the season or just watch the playoffs or just watch the Super Bowl. You know, I may do that with like the Bruins, but like, I don't get the same sort of joy out of watching when I saw the Bruins. You know, they won it sometime over the last decade. I don't remember what, 2014, 2015? I don't remember when they won it. But I don't get the same type of joy. I didn't get the same type of joy out of watching that as I did the Patriots winning the Super Bowl. Even seeing in 2018, Wim, even seeing the Red Sox win the World Series live in L.A., I did not get the same type of joy I did watching the Patriots win the Super Bowl on TV because of the process. The process wasn't the same for me. Am I a Red Sox fan? Do I have a level of process being a Red Sox fan? Yeah, because I've been a lifelong fan. I check the scores. I know what's going on with the team. But I don't watch it and engage with it the same way I engage with the Patriots. so it's not as enjoyable without the process.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine like a life that is just those endings and it being any way fulfilling. Like all the hard work and even the things that aren't, you know, even the things that aren't pleasant that you do in the process are all wrapped into the process and what makes it fulfilling.
Yeah. And one other thing I wanted to talk about here about Snyder's appearance on this podcast is he does in like the last 15, 20 minutes of the episode talk about like how understanding other people's point of view and having empathy for them is important. Now, empathy is one of those buzzwords that when you hear it from someone, you automatically assume they're a leftist, right? Oh, if we just all had empathy for everyone, the world would be a better place. But I think that's something that we've touched on the show before, is the idea of if you truly believe in individualism, if you truly believe in it, isn't part of that having respect for the fact that other people have their own individual lives and they're living them and they have experiences for them and understanding that they're going through things that are different from your own? So, you know, he says, he's like, I want to see all different types of stories. I want to see a movie with a trans lead. You know, he says that. And doesn't that go into, William, what we were just saying? Agree or disagree with critical race theory? Isn't there a possibility that there would be a good movie? Don't you want to see a good movie that addresses critical race theory? That portrays
it? That would be
great. Right. A movie that portrays a trans lead rationally would be a great movie, would it not?
Yeah, I think that would be wonderful. I mean, that's the problem we have now with all these woke movies is that they can't write a villain, right? That because they end up constructing the world in such a way that the villain is actually the good guy.
Right. Well, they can't write a hero because the hero is actually the villain.
Yeah, the hero becomes so narcissistic that they become ineffectual in reality. So they can't even I would argue they can't even be the villain.
I mean, this kind of goes, I didn't even mean to make this connection, but this kind of goes to the whole Cruella thing, right? So Cruella was such a good movie that at the end of the movie, like, you're supposed to believe she becomes the villain in 101 Dalmatians, but they did such a good job of making her heroic that it's impossible to see her as a villain anymore because she was just standing up for herself and standing up for her values. And you're kind of like, wait, I'm supposed to not like her anymore? Like, so that's almost a symptom of the same problem, isn't it?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So the issue, look, people are such concrete bound thinkers and, you know, they're going to hear the word empathy and they're going to hear, you know, oh, I want to see a movie with a trans lead. And you automatically go, oh, well, that's a social justice warrior. But again, it's about the why. It's about the process. And that's something I've expressed to you before. And I still express. I don't understand the process of transitioning. I don't get it. I don't understand any of it. So actually seeing it portrayed would be a worthwhile thing if it's portrayed in a way that is comprehensible to other people. And it's not just like, oh, hey, I'm just going to put my, and I'm going to use a controversial word, I'm not just going to vomit my feelings onto a screen and expect you to go, oh yeah, that's so profound. That's that person's experience.
Yeah.
It has to be comprehensible. So I would recommend anyone who can go listen to that episode of the Nonprofit Podcast. Like I said, it's 3.5 hours, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. And if you want to truly, truly understand Zack Snyder, that's the thing to go and listen to. He's done a lot of interviews recently, and I haven't even listened to all of them because it's impossible to keep up with all of them. This is the one to listen to, the Nonprofit Podcast. And I will say this, people always say, don't you want to have him on your show? I did. I used to. And then I listened to this episode and I don't really have much I'm curious about him anymore. I mean, I could ask him specific things about Sucker Punch and about Watchmen and about the Fountainhead adaptation eventually as far as concrete things. But to me, a concrete interview is not as interesting. That's something that you sort of like sit around and bullshit with your buddies about. So if you want the mid-side interview of Zack Snyder, just go listen to the Nonprofit Podcast. That's the closest you're going to get to it. Because I think we talk about his stuff. We have a pretty good beeline on it. There's not really a need to interview him. So, all right. Want to talk about some other art stuff, William?
I am ready.
All right, hit the music. If you'd like to continue with these discussions, these topics during the week, you can join our Discord channel. Had a lot of great content in there this week. Had some topic suggestions that are awesome. Probably use in a future episode. I already had this episode outlined. I was busy with wrestling this week, so I didn't use the topic suggestions. But there's some great content in there. So you want to continue this conversation during the week with us and other Midsiders, you can go to themidside.com/podcast or themidside.com. Click on any episode link. And in there, there's a link for join our Discord. We'd love to talk to you. We'd love to keep this discussion going. So for the review this week, William, I know a lot of people probably want to hear me talk about In the Heights. I did not see that movie for a couple reasons. One, when we did Trailer Takedown, I was turned off by like the whole idea of the association of the Dreamers with an immigrant class, especially with Hispanics, because of all the recent controversy that erred far too much for collectivism towards me, especially because the movie is done by Miranda, and I didn't like sort of the undercurrent, the undertones of Hamilton. I thought there was a lot of great stuff, but I didn't like the undertones. Based upon people's reviews, I will see In the Heights eventually, but I didn't have time to get to the theater because of wrestling, so I opted not to see that movie. I will make time to see it eventually, though. But for this week, I did something I could stay home and watch. I watched the first episode of Loki on Disney Plus. William, are you aware of this movie?
I'm aware of the show. I've heard Kevin Feige's interview where he's talking about this is going to affect the whole MCU with this series, and then I've seen I saw Nerdrotic's review of it, so I know a little bit about his take is. So I'm interested to hear your take.
Who did you hear?
Nerdrotic. Gary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Feige says that every time, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think that's his job to say that every time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a marketing thing, so I don't really take that seriously. But I'm scrolling. Okay, there it is. So I watched this show for one reason, because we all know my love loss with the MCU. And you know, I don't hate the MCU. I have problems with it ideologically. But there are also some excellent things about it execution-wise, and that's part of sort of where my head goes after this. But I watched this for one reason. This deals with time travel, timelines, William. So the basic premise is, in Endgame, the Avengers had to travel back in time to collect the Time Stones, or not just the Time Stones, the Infinity Stones, sorry, to beat Thanos. Well, when they did, they traveled back to the first Avengers and made it so Loki was able to grab the Tesseract, which is the MacGuffin that helped him seize power in the first Avengers, or pursue power in the first Avengers, and he was able to grab that. Now, he was not supposed to, so that altered the timeline. It sent him back, in the beginning of this episode, it sent him back to Mongolia, and I don't remember the year. But because of that, he became like a variant, is I think the term they used. Well, I don't remember what TVA stands for. It's the Time something authority, time variance authority, something like that. But yeah, basically, that
the Tennessee Valley Authority, right?
The Tennessee Valley Authority. I wonder if that was on purpose. I doubt it. Captures him, and he goes into this whole bureaucratic organization that's basically about keeping the one pure timeline in existence. Now, I don't know, William, how you continue with this story. Doesn't this then become the most important story in all of the MCU? Because these are the people making the one pure timeline. So maybe the point of the show is you're going to destroy this organization. I don't know. But Throughout the episode, Loki has to confront who he is and confront his past in order to become a detective for the TVA with Owen Wilson in order to hunt a fugitive variant. And the fugitive he's hunting is himself. Now, here's the thing. I don't think, William, that this is the most interesting premise you can possibly come up with for this show. You have a group of people who've decided what the one pure timeline is, and the way you want to go is someone's hunting himself? Wouldn't you want to be investigating who these people are and how this timeline is the pure one and how, if that's good or not? I know, maybe they'll go in that direction. But the major thing, like, so I tweeted, I'm going to read my tweet. I watched the first episode of Loki. He mocks the idea of the TVA controlling everyone as absurd and then believes freedom is the greatest trick ever played. Stupid. Now, somebody told me that's Loki being a hypocrite, but I don't think that's what they're going for. I think that's just an inaccuracy with the writing because I don't think they're dealing with these issues on the level they're dealing with. And because of that, I started to come up with this dichotomy in my head, William. I started to come up with this dichotomy in my head. And before I go to the dichotomy, I'm going to give this a solid bro, right? This is a middle of the road rating. And there's a reason for that, and it has to do with the dichotomy. I started to come up with this idea of watchability versus profundity. That these are two axes on which to judge a piece of art, a piece of story, a piece of narrative, a piece of visual art for its quality. Because I think both of these are important, right? It doesn't matter how profound a piece of work is if it's unwatchable. Because if you don't enjoy it, it's not a good piece of art. Likewise, it doesn't matter how watchable something is if there's no wisdom in it. If you're not learning something from it. If you're not growing from it. There's no, William, process to it. It's just an endpoint. It's just gratification. It's just hedonism. Now, I think that Marvel tends to be on the watchability side and less on the profundity side, which is why I have a problem with it, especially when they try and be profound in, you know, Endgame and make this grand statement on Tony Stark. You know, the idea of the sacrificing for the greater good, as if that's profound, right? And the example I gave, you know, I tweeted about this as well. The example I gave is Goosebumps books, William. Remember, do you remember Goosebumps?
Yeah, yeah.
They were eminently readable, were they not?
Yeah, super easy to read.
And enjoyable. You're always like, what's going to happen next? This is cool. All the premises they came up with were so cool. Horrorland.
Creative, yep.
Yeah. The Night of the Living Dummy. Or you took a photograph, say cheese and die. You took a picture with a camera and then you were going to die. It's sort of like the Final Destination movies.
Yeah.
So creative of a premise. So great to watch. Such great acting in a lot of them. Some such cool deaths. I'm reminded of a Motion City soundtrack, a lyric that I loved, and I wish I had gotten the t-shirt for it. It's one of my greatest regrets in life is not getting this t-shirt. Like a horror movie, I'm torn in opposite directions. The plot sucks, but the killings are gorgeous. And this is something I've thought about for a long time. It's something like, I used to love Survivor. I love Survivor because the game encapsulated what life was. There's only $1 million prize and you have to work together with other people without making them mad and without taking advantage of them. Because if you take advantage of them, they're not going to vote for you at the end to give you the $1 million. But only one person can win. So how do we balance in life this idea that not everyone's going to win, quote unquote, with this idea of we all have to work together to get there? But now the game's just become, the editing's just become more about blindsides. It's become more about spectacle. And I use that word because, and I'm going to do more reading on this, but Aristotle has these couple of concepts, spectacle and catharsis. Catharsis is this, you know, you've heard of the idea of catharsis, right, William?
Yeah.
Yeah. Catharsis is the idea of, when you go through something, it helps you feel better and helps you to a better end point.
Yeah, it's like a healing. It's part of healing. It's a right. Feeling of, well, not necessarily healing, but of putting some spiritual distance between something that caused pain or trauma.
Right. And that's what he said the purpose of art was catharsis. But then he also talked about spectacle. Now, I would say you can only have catharsis if there's some sort of wisdom that helps you get that distance, helps you understand it, helps you grow from it. So
yeah, there's an externalization that's kind of wrapped up into that in my head.
Right. And I think Aristotle probably talks about all these things. So I need to go back and read Poetics and look at what he's talking about with those terms. But that's what I'm toying with right now. I think, and this is what I'd like your opinion on. I think in our culture, we're placing more value on watchability or Aristotle's idea of spectacle than we are on profundity or Aristotle's idea of catharsis. What do you think?
I think exploring that idea of catharsis would be really interesting because I kind of haven't engaged with stuff like that in a while, so it's sort of rattling a couple things in my brain, but thinking about, you know, one of the things that I really get out of art in general is seeing that sort of shape of an emotion, right? And being able to experience it through some sort of external medium helps me connect to my own emotion, if that makes sense. Because sometimes it's hard for me to put into words like how I'm feeling. And oftentimes I can think of it more in terms of, oh, that's how this character felt in this piece of work, or that this sculpture, this painting, that's the emotion that character was going through, right? And it helps me think about how I'm feeling about things as well.
Right. Well, and that's the wisdom, right? The wisdom, the profundity is, it's the ability to capture something true in your art and reflect that back to the audience. And to wrap it back to Loki, when I look at the character of Loki, or I look at Owen Wilson, and I look at the other minor characters, I didn't see them as anything but vehicles for portraying this premise of the TVA, the Time Variance Authority, or whatever it stands for, of this idea of the one true timeline. There was no truth about their experiences. There was no depth of ideas that I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. I didn't see Loki struggling with anything that was human that gave me any sort of movement forward in my understanding of the world or reflected any sort of reality back to me, whether it's my own or someone's. They just struck me as devices for the spectacle, devices for the watchability. Does that make sense?
Do you think some of it is from, you know, Marvel has struggled at times to get that sort of characterization, and especially recently, like the second half of this whatever current iteration we are in the MCU story structure, they've sort of undermined all their characters through this, like, you know, quote unquote Marvel humor, kind of taking all of those little moments where you would develop character and instead just inserted jokes because they're more watchable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great sort of microcosm and a great sort of concrete manifestation of what I'm talking about. The jokes are a perfect example of that because it undermines the reality of it, of the reflecting of it, because it takes the gravitas out of it. So I think that's a great example of what you're saying. So, look, it's not that Marvel's bad, right? It's not that I hate Marvel. And no, I'll watch more of Loki. I'm not going to lie. I love time travel stuff, and I want to see what they do with this. Like, I'm a sucker, dude. You say it's a time travel thing, I'm going to watch it. Or Parallel Universes. I watched that Parallel movie just because I liked the idea of it. You know, I love that episode of The Next Generation where Worf interacts with all his parallel lives. It's not a great episode. It's not profound as an episode. But, William, concept of an episode, isn't that episode of The Next Generation one of the most creative concepts of an episode on Next Generation?
Yeah, definitely a nice hard sci-fi episode, right? We got where you're talking about like the consequences, not just to those other, you know, parallel things, but like consequences for Worf as a character, right?
Yeah. So. But again, it doesn't have that sort of catharsis to it. It doesn't have that profoundness. It's just all sort of premise. It's all watchability. But it was enjoyable to watch when I first watched it. So I'll keep watching it.
Yeah.
And look, if that's what you care more about, if you care more about watchability, there's a lot of stuff that I say isn't that great. But, you know, it is. You can still watch it. Or the inverse. Like, I think something that hurts Spiral, the Book of Saw, the Chris Rock movie, is its watchability isn't as high as, like, the first Saw or other movies. But its profundity, its catharsis is through the roof. So to me, I'm willing to take a little bit off of that watchability, off of that spectacle. You know, Chris Rock's not the greatest actor. The person who plays the villain and the voice of the Spiral killer is kind of ridiculous. But I'm willing to take that because the catharsis, the profundity is through the roof. I'm willing to take that. So I'm interested, William, what did that review you watched say?
Well, I think Gary, just to try to summarize what Nerd Roddick was saying, he was sort of talking about how it was a lot of just talking and setup, and that the characters, like you were saying, that the characters were just there for the plot and the premise, and there was really nothing, there was really no substance. And he just thought it was boring for that reason. Because I think, like, I would certainly say that Gary, as a critic, is way more interested in the profundity and the catharsis. Now, he loves good spectacle, right? But those are the things that make it more interesting. And he was just basically said it was very boring because there
100%.
Was no, you know, there was nothing there.
Right. No, but that's Marvel. That's, so I was bored as fuck at the first two episodes of WandaVision, or the first episode, because it was the same thing. It was the same exact thing that you just described his review. That's almost exactly the review I would give WandaVision. If I didn't review it on the show, I probably said that if I did. Because it's exactly that. And honestly, I would have been bored by Loki if I don't love time travel things. And if it wasn't similar to my own story I wrote about I had a time core with the Supreme Council socially engineering the timeline. Right? If it wasn't similar to that, I would have been bored. But I love the mechanics of that shit as a writer. So I get 100% why someone would be bored by Loki. I get it. And that's, to me, that's the issue. I don't want to make them oppositional because I think they're both important. But I think that's the issue if you go all towards spectacle. I think you end up desensitizing yourself. It's sort of like if you eat McDonald's every day, right? If you have McDonald's like once a month or once every couple months, you're like, wow, that tastes good. But if you eat McDonald's like 5 days in a row, you're like, fuck this. This doesn't even taste good. Why do I even like this? Why am I spending money on this? Or like ice cream, right? If you have ice cream every day, it becomes less special. But you have it once a week or once a month or once every 2 months, it's like, wow, this ice cream is really fucking good. And it's the same thing with, you know, like I said, with Survivor. If every episode's a fucking blindside, you're like, fuck this, this is boring. Or Marvel. To me, Marvel gets boring because it's the same thing. It's like, am I supposed to be like, oh my God, I feel like the spectacle of this episode is supposed to be, oh my God, he's hunting himself. Oh wow, it's so mind-blowing. And it's just not mind-blowing because you're just like, of course they would do something like that. And that's what I got to the end of. And I was like, of course they would do something like that. And I was like, man, I was like, I wish that was more creative. Like, I wish he was hunting Thor or Thanos or something else. Because it's like they went with the way that they thought would cause the most clicks or whatever. All right, do you have anything you want to add, William, or do you want to go on to some trailers?
No, let's move on to some trailers.
Okay, so remember, I post these trailers on Saturday in the Discord. So if you want to watch the trailers before the episode or watch them after the episode or during the episode, right, click. Or we talk, you watch a trailer, we talk, right? You can look in the Discord and you'll see all of them in there.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Monsters at Work is Disney's Disney Plus television adaptation. It's so weird to me that we still call it television, William, even though it's a streaming show. So I just will just say series. Disney's series about the Monsters, Inc. characters. In it, the scare factory has transitioned into a laugh factory. And I will say that there is synergy there. There is a laugh floor. I was going to say experience. That's not what I'm looking for. Attraction is the word I was looking for. Attraction at Disney World, at the Magic Kingdom, where you go in and the monsters are more worried about getting laughs than they are getting scares anymore. And there's somebody who applies to Monsters, Inc. and wants to be a scarer. And they put him on the facilities team rather than putting him as working for the company because he can't get laughs anymore. Now, the animation's top-notch. It looks like Monsters, Inc. It looks like Monsters University. The voice work is top-notch. All the characters are back. So all of that is great. The watchability for this, I think, is great. I don't think you can argue there's bad watchability about this. Now, I don't know if this is intentional or not, but the idea that he is more in touch, the main character, if he's the main character, this new guy, is more in touch with what monsters actually are than what Monsters, Inc. is, right? Monsters are supposed to be for scaring, not for laughter. And he gets put into the more concrete blue-collar work. I don't know if there's commentary going on that, but it seems like there could be. Regardless, I'm always looking for something to watch like this. I'm looking for a series. I like Pixar. I like Monsters, Inc. I hope they don't destroy the show and undervalue it, or destroy the property and undervalue it by doing this. But I will definitely watch this. Hug.
Hug.
All right, so, yeah, I watched this, and I don't know that I really care. I wasn't hugely into Monsters University, and I can understand revisiting this. I can imagine that the production cost of this animation in the years since the original Monsters movie has come down so far that this makes sense. But the trailer itself didn't really give me any compelling reason to be interested in it. I guess for me personally, just not being so connected to these characters. I mean, I contrast it with, you know, the Aladdin, you know, animated series. Like, those I was interested in because I was really interested in the characters, right? And I kind of wanted to live more in that universe. But for whatever reason, I'm not very interested in living in this universe anymore. So I think I'm going to very lightly tackle it.
Tackle!
It's because you hate Polish people. Mike Wazowski!
Second trailer.
Ron's Gone Wrong is an animated movie, not by Pixar. I forget who it's by, but the animation looked excellent. In it, every child gets a sort of AI robot friend called a Bebot. And then this kid, Ron, gets one, except Ron's is wrong. It's fucked up, it's broken, it doesn't work properly. And that's the premise of it. Again, looked watchable, but there wasn't a lot else going on here. Maybe they're reaching for something about our over-reliance on devices and things like that. There was a line about sort of like, I need you to make friends. And it's kind of like, why do you need the Bebot to make friends? And look like everyone was being mean to him because his Bebot sucked. So there's stuff that could be going on here. I'm willing to give this a chance. Again, this is something that I would see if there was nothing else out on that weekend. Otherwise, it would become a second or third option. So I'm going to give this a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
Man, Justin, I'm going to tell you what. California Justin would have definitely tackled this movie. This looks like a toy movie from the 80s. Pushing cartoon from the 80s. Like, you know, there people are just going to sell these, like, whatever they're called, these Bebots or whatever.
I'd buy one.
So, yeah, I don't know. This doesn't look interesting at all to me. The animation looks great. I would give you that. But, like, what's the commentary here? Is it on consumerism, maybe? I don't know. It just didn't look good, Justin. The story didn't look good in the trailer. So I'm going to tackle it.
Tackle. Third trailer.
Invasion is an Apple Plus. Is it called Apple Plus? Is it called? I don't know what it's called anymore. A series about a world where they're being invaded by aliens. You want to talk about the story not looking interesting, William? You're going to get mad at me. Okay? I already saw Falling Skies. To me, this looked like Falling Skies meets Signs. I've already seen Signs. Now, then again, I loved both of them a lot. So should I like this one? Maybe. But there looked to be nothing interesting about this to me. Nothing stood out. Nothing stood out. I don't have Apple whatever it's called. I'm not going to go out of my way to get that. Is it Apple TV Plus?
Yep.
Fucking, what the... Too many fucking names. I'm not going to go out of my way. This is a tackle.
Tackle.
Justin, in a surprising turn of events, I also agree with you on this one. This had all premise and no, like, no hook. Right? We've seen these hooks before, like you said. Maybe we're too old and we've seen it all. But as far as, like, good sci-fi, this looks like boilerplate sci-fi. There was nothing really interesting, at least presented in the trailer. I'm sure there'll be another trailer. I'm willing to give that trailer a chance. But you know what? I'd rather just watch C, which I know I posted in Discord. If you're on Discord, I think it's August 27th. The season 2 of C is coming out on Apple TV Plus. So I'm very excited about C, Jason Momoa's project. But this one doesn't look interesting. I might give the first episode a try just because I'm so starved for sci-fi. But I think based on just this trailer and all the other things that are coming out this fall, I think I'm going to tackle it.
Tackle?
I haven't
Final
seen...
Final trailer.
You're going to play the other one now, aren't you? No? Okay.
Way to step on it, Justin.
God damn it. Now this has become a game. I was trying to say something. I haven't seen C, but I saw that Dave Bautista is in season 2, so that makes me more willing to watch it because Jason Momoa fighting Dave Bautista would be pretty awesome. But yeah. No Sudden Move is an HBO Max exclusive movie with a stellar cast. It is a stellar cast. So I clicked on this trailer and I was like, this cast is awesome. And it also has the John Hamm factor, where John Hamm tends to pick really, really fucking good movies. The dude picks good projects. So I clicked on this and I was like, I'm really excited about this. And then, William, talk about lack of a plot. I have no idea what the fuck this movie is about. It's like people are trying to pull off a heist or something, and then other people are trying to hunt them and stop them, but other people are trying to double cross them. I don't understand this at all. There's nothing about this I understand. Hopefully there'll be another trailer, but I think I see why they just dumped it on HBO Max rather than put it in theaters. This seems like one of those that would have went into theaters and failed miserably. I don't get this at all. Maybe you can, in your review, William, redeem this for me. But for me, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, I think, is this trying to like be like Usual Suspects crossed with like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. It just seems Mad Men, maybe. I don't know. It's hard to make sense. I wonder if this is could just be one of those movies where part of it is just the journey of understanding the universe, which is fine, but why present something so confusing as the trailer, right? Imagine if they had just cut a trailer with the same clips and just less dialogue, right? Because I feel like the dialogue only further confused what was going on, right? And there's no... You know, we joke about the MacGuffin, right? But there's, like, is this chick that they're carrying around just the MacGuffin? Like, that wasn't even clear till like, two-thirds of the way through the trailer. I don't know what's going on. This is a fascinating trailer. Fascinating, not in a good way, in the, like, who the fuck thought this would, like, attract people to be interested in the movie way. I'm going to tackle it.
Tackle.
All right, that brings an end to this trip into the midside. What did we learn, William?
I learned that we can go from hugging a ton of movies, one trailer takedown, to tackling nearly all of them the very next time we do trailer takedown. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
First of all, I agree with that. Even the ones I hugged, it's not like a super hug, right? It's like, oh, hey, here's some content that could be decent. I'll watch it. I learned a lot this week. I mean, this whole idea of spectacle versus catharsis, I really want to look in more into that. I thoroughly enjoyed all of our conversations. I think the critical race theory conversation was really, really important. The idea of education, not indoctrination, I think is a really, really important thing that we talked about. And I want to thank all of you for listening to the show. Without all of you, we would not have a show. This would just be me literally talking to a wall in the closet. And I appreciate that because I don't like feeling crazy. And like I said at the top, we're only as crazy as you think we are. I want to thank our Liberty.me listeners. We love you guys out there. Is Liberty.me even functional? Let me know out there if Liberty.me is still functional so I can either keep promoting them or stop promoting them. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. TheMidSide.com/store has some old ass t-shirts on there. When I say old, I mean designs. You're not buying like used t-shirts. TheMidSide.com/thecut. You can read my novel, A Fictionalization of What Happened on the Production of Justice League. You can also support us via Patreon or Locals, TheMidSide.com/Patreon, TheMidSide.com/Locals. And William, what's the best way you can help us?
Tell a friend.
Or tell a stranger. I told the guy who helped me at the Mac store today get a replacement power cord for my MacBook and also get a new iPhone about my podcast, and he saved it and said he's going to listen to it. So tell anyone. It doesn't even have to be friends anymore. Just tell a person. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski reminding you that if things get back, things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a Liberty.me day. Right as you were closing, doing the closing of the show, Remy decided to wake up and he is just jumping all over me and trying to chew the cables, and like, he just went into full puppy mode just all of a sudden. So I think the timer of the episode, we have a perfect indicator when the episode needs to end.
Sweet. We'll remember that from now on. The puppy indicator.
Yep.
All right. Talk to you later.
Later.